If you're the police, where are your badges?
Badges? We ain't got no badges. We don't need no badges. I don't have to show you any stinking badges.
Get it, Jake. It's Chinatown.
What we've got here is failure to communicate.
I'm a man. Well, nobody's perfect.
Fasten your seatbelts. It's going to be a bumpy night.
He wins, he takes the cock. I win, I take his finger. Is that so strange?
Line engine, you're up against a monster 20 miles long and 2 miles wide, 40 square miles of agonizing death. You can't stop it.
I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore.
Round up the usual suspects.
Silent Breed is people!
Wait a minute. Wait a minute. You ain't heard nothing yet.
Welcome to Paleo Cinema Podcast.
Paleo Cinema Podcast is a fortnightly podcast about movies. All kinds of movies. Crime movies, science fiction movies, horror movies, movies with cool actors you've never heard of in them, movies where CGI stands for criminals, girls and ice picks, classic movies, cult movies, and any other movie Terry wants to rant about as long as the movie is more than 20 years old. You can find the podcast website at paleo-cinema.com. The voicemail number is 206-350-5440. Or you can email or send MP3 voicemails to cultguru@gmail.com. That's cult with a K. This podcast usually contains swearing and is probably not safe for work unless you work in a brothel or a David Mamet film.
Hello and welcome to Paleo Cinema Podcast 90. Yes, that's 90, not 19. My name's Terry Frost, and this time around we are still on the A to Z project, and we are on to the L's. In this case being Laura from 1944, produced and directed by Otto Preminger, and starring Dana Andrews, Gene Tierney, and Clifton Webb. And the other movie is actually from a year earlier than that, 1943, and it is Powell and Pressburger's The Life and Death of Colonel Blimp, a movie I've been wanting to do on the podcast for a long time, and I have name-checked it a number of times, but this one is the real deal. Both of them, superb films, and I highly recommend them. If you haven't watched them, if you have watched them but not for a while, I recommend that you do so again. So, how is everybody? The renovations are heading towards a climax here. The backyard and the front yard have been totally renovated and landscaped and all that kind of stuff. We haven't got many plants yet. In fact, we have six, if you include the tree. But it's now heading into summer. It's not a good time to plant things. So come about March, we're going to hit the nurseries and really start putting together a really lovely functioning garden. The pictures are up on Facebook. If you haven't friended me on Facebook, please do so. And so that's one aspect of things. The floor in the kitchen's in. We've got the kitchen cabinets in. We've got the flooring in all the rooms so we can start moving furniture back where we had it. We've got carpet in the front room, which sounds a bit like a euphemism, but isn't. And now all we have to do is get the bench tops in, the plumbing in to do the sink, and the stovetop and other things like that, and the dishwasher, and then the splashbacks, and we are finished, and we can forget renovation until the turn of the 22nd century. So that hasn't left me a lot of room, either time-wise or in a sense of spatially, to watch a lot of movies, but I'll crank up the Mizzo and we'll just see what I have there for it. I only did one movie on the radio since I last talked at you, really, and that was this week. I recorded Vanishing Point, the Richard C. Serafian movie with Barry Newman in it, one of the great metaphysical car chase movies of the 1970s, and we had a good time with that one too. Really got off on it. I watched a couple of Barry Newman movies. I watched another one called The Lawyer, which was the basis for the TV series Petrocelli. It was actually a feature film rather than a TV movie, where Barry Newman played the Petrocelli character, a kind of lawyer in a desert town. Very smart, but a bit of a smart ass. And that was quite interesting. It's directed by Sidney J. Fury, the same guy who directed the Ipcrest file, of all things. And it's worth checking out. It's a nice little murder mystery. And I did enjoy that, as well as enjoying, of course, Vanishing Point. Let's see what else I did. I watched Kismet, not the musical version from 1955, directed by Vincente Minnelli, but the 1944 version, which has Ronald Coleman, Marlene Dietrich in it, and it's a lot of fun. It's one of those beautiful 1940s Technicolor films where the colour just pops like it doesn't do in modern films. And Marlene Dietrich does an exotic dance, and Ronald Coleman's having a bit of fun with things, and it's worth checking out if you get a chance, if you're into that kind of Arabian Nights, mid-20th century American fantasy universe kind of thing. Let me see what else. I saw a documentary which I picked up off Cinemageddon called Bubblegum Music is the Naked Truth, which is a history of bubblegum music all the way from things like the Ohio Express and those things right up to Crap by Michael Jackson. So that's interesting too, because bubblegum music I heard a lot of when I was a kid, and I had an interest in. It's a very low budget documentary. I think Alamo Drafthouse had something to do with it, but if you can find a copy of that, it's quite an interesting little thing to check out. Let's see what else. I did see a 1940s spy movie starring Humphrey Bogart and Mary Astor and Sidney Greenstreet called Across the Pacific. It was an interesting film, partly because most of it was directed by John Huston, who then had to go off into the Pacific and shoot war documentaries, and it was completed by somebody else. It's a little bit silly, but it's a bit of fun too, and it's Bogart in a slightly different role. Mary Astor not as a villain, and Sidney Greenstreet chewing up the scenery as usual. So if you get a chance to check that out, I got it off TCM, so TCM does show it, at least in Australia, fairly regularly. I did watch a blaxploitation movie as well, Black Samson, who's got Rodney Tarkington in it, and William Smith playing the villain and just going totally to town, beating up chicks, totally over the top, playing an Italian mobster, and really one of the lesser blaxploitation films, but if you want to check it out, do. Let's have a look here. I know what else I saw. I watched A Long Last Love. Really a train wreck of a musical based on Cole Porter's music. That's the one starring Burt Reynolds trying to be suave. Sybil Shepherd. It's also got Eileen Brennan in it. John Hillerman's in it. And it is a little bit of fun. And Madeleine Kahn, of course, is in it as well. It's one of those things where you go, what the fuck? But you still keep watching it. So I did see that. The kind of takeaway from this fortnight of movie watching for me is I did see Brighton Rock, the 1940s version starring little Dickie Attenborough and William Hartnell, who later on went to be the first Doctor Who in a very different role. And Brighton Rock by the Bolting Brothers blew me away. I'm going to talk about it on a podcast. It's in the book there. Really intensely interesting crime drama based on a Graham Greene novel. I hear the remake is shit. I've heard that from a couple of people when I mentioned that I had seen this on Facebook. So I am going to dodge that particular bullet for a while, and I'm definitely going to watch Brighton Rock again in the not too distant future. But that's about all I've been watching lately. I'm going to take a break and do one of the promos people sent me. And when I come back, I think I'll talk about the life and death of Colonel Blimp first.
Do you enjoy movies like Carnival of Souls, The Mole People, Black Sunday, and The Tingler? Do you find yourself late at night reading magazines such as Film Max, Chiller Theater, or Monster Bash? Do you love vintage television programs like Sky King, Outer Limits, and The Time Tunnel? Do you find yourself surfing the net looking for the next monster movie festival or expo? Do you enjoy hearing anecdotes, cinematic details, and unusual insights into some of your favorite movies? If you answered yes to any of the above, you're encouraged to join your host, Vince Rotolo, as he examines some of the latest horror, sci-fi, and cult theatrical releases, new DVDs to add to your collection, and of course, the old classics, both good and bad. He even interviews people throughout B-Moviedom. So tune into B-MovieCast at bmoviecast.com.
Resistance is futile.
There we go. We've got Vince's promo and a little bit of Swingle Singers there just for something a little bit different. So let's move on to the life and death of Colonel Blimp. Now, the name Colonel Blimp predates the movie by a good decade or so. Colonel Blimp was a cartoon character in the Evening Standard in the 1930s. Wikipedia says he was pompous, irascible, jingoistic, and stereotypically British. Lowe developed the character after hearing two military men in a Turkish bath declare that cavalry officers should be entitled to wear their spurs inside tanks. So basically, he makes stupid, bombastic, militaristic statements. He's a little bit like a kind of 1930s, 1940s, one-man Fox News. So, but the character as portrayed in the movie is significantly different. He's a lot more sympathetic and a lot more interesting, and he's not just like a one-punch joke. So the movie was made by the Archers, of course, Michael Powell and Emmerich Pressburg. We've talked about them before in the podcast. Two of the greatest filmmakers of the middle of 20th century. Awesomely humanistic, awesomely humane, and incredibly imaginative with what they did as well. The movie stars, well, there's basically three characters in it of importance. Roger Livesey, a well-known English character actor. People might remember him in The League of Gentlemen in 1959 when he was somewhat older. And Deborah Carr, of course, who had a long and distinguished career and managed to survive a Rodgers and Hammerstein musical as well. My tongue's getting a bit stuck at the moment. And the third character, and for me, the most important, is Anton Warbrook. Remember back a while when I talked about La Ronde, the French film about the romances going in a big circle of people? Anton Warbrook was the narrator in that, and incredibly different from the character he played in this film. I love it when you see actors, particularly in older films, and it doesn't always happen. Usually people play to a type. In cinema, at least, and maybe that's the American influence, who knows. But Anton Warbrook did an incredibly wide range of characters in his film career, and it's a lovely thing to see, just seeing the art of the man. But I'm waffling a little bit. Okay, so the plot of the film, I'll kind of paraphrase from Wikipedia because it's not always cogent. Film begins in 1943 in the middle of the Second World War. Major General Clive Wynne Candy, played by Roger Livesey, is a leader of a Home Guard squad in a training exercise. He is captured in a Turkish bath by soldiers from the opposing side, led by the young Lieutenant Spud Wilson. Wilson is struck preemptively, breaking established conventions of war, and he believes this is how the Germans fight. He ignores Candy's outraged protest that war starts at midnight, and they scuffle and fall into a bathing pool. From there, the film segues back 40 years to 1902, when Candy was a young lieutenant and begins an extended flashback, starting with his days as a young and impetuous officer. The flashback lasts for most of the film, following Candy's life, eventually leading back to the altercation in the Turkish bath. That pretty much nails it down. And there are a whole bunch of great character actors in this film too. You've got Felix Aylmer's in there, Reginald Tate, Albert Modner, who played, I believe, at one stage Sherlock Holmes. Let's see, Roland Culver's in there. He's a character actor people have known from any number of films. John Laurie, who later on went to be in Dad's Army, playing the Scottish guy in Dad's Army. Ursula Jeans, and yeah, basically a terrific ensemble cast. Now, the production was a bit fraught because basically Winston Churchill objected to the film strongly, and Winston Churchill was pretty much running Britain at the time. Of course, this is 1943. His problem was that the English officer was portrayed as a pompous ass, and the German officer, Theo Kretschmer-Schuldorf, played by Anton Warbrook, had a more realistic view of the world and a more realistic view of politics, and in a lot of ways is an incredibly more sympathetic character. So you've got to remember, this is the middle of the war. This is when the whole idea of Britain was under threat. Not only were they going to be invaded, but as an independent country, as a nation, as a culture, everything they had and believed in was under threat. And along come the archers, doing good work, who portray a sympathetic anti-Nazi German officer who is intelligent, passionate, compassionate, and really kind of is the heart of the film, as indeed Wing Candy is in a way, but is the heart of the film. But anyway, I'm going to play a clip first, and then I'll play a second clip after a little while, showing you one of the best speeches ever done in English language cinema. Okay, the first clip's during the war games when a young officer bails up General Wing Candy, Major General Wing Candy, in the Turkish bath. So I'll just play that. It's a little bit long, but I don't mind playing long ones for this movie. It's just a wonderful piece of cinema, and the whole movie itself is about 2 hours, 40 minutes, so I'm only using a small portion of it.
Sir!
Go away.
General Wing Candy.
What? Who is it?
Lieutenant Wilson, sir. 2nd Battalion, the Loamshire, sir.
What do you want, eh?
Well, sir, I'm afraid, sir, we've...
Well, say it, man. Say it. I've no time to waste.
Oh, yes, you have, sir.
I beg your pardon, sir.
You've got all night, sir.
Attention!
I'm afraid he can't come.
Why?
He's a prisoner, sir.
What's going on here?
Invasion, sir.
But you damned young idiot, war starts at midnight, haven't you been told?
Oh, yes, sir. That's why we're here.
But may I ask on what authority?
On the authority of these guns and these men, sir.
Authority? Authority? How dare you, sir? How dare you? Get out of here, sir, you and your gang of awful militia gangsters. Get out!
Popeye!
Sir!
Guard this man! Stuffy!
Sir!
Go to the cubicles, find which is General Wing Candy's. You'll find a brown pigskin case there. Bring it.
Yes, sir.
But you can't do that. The code is in that case. The whole exercise will be a farce if you have that code.
Oh, no, sir. This is going to be the real thing, sir.
But war starts at midnight.
Oh, yes, you say war starts at midnight. How do you know the enemy says so, too?
But, my dear fellow, that was agreed, wasn't it?
Agreed, my foot. How many agreements have been kept by the enemy since this war started? We agree to keep to the rules of the game and they go on kicking us in the pants. When I joined the army, the only agreement I entered into was to defend my country by every means at my disposal, not only by the National Sporting Club rules, but by every means that have existed since Cain slugged Abel.
Stop it.
Don't we know that they're counting on us to keep to the rules?
Stop it.
That they openly boast about it? That they laugh at us?
Stop it! Lieutenant Watson, or whatever your name is, you are not in Hyde Park with an audience of loafers. I am Major General Wing Candy. These other gentlemen have all seen service, distinguished service with the British Army.
All I can say, sir, that when Napoleon said that an army marched on its stomach, I better stop, sir.
You're an extremely impudent young officer. But let me tell you that in 40 years' time, you'll be an old gentleman too. And if your belly keeps pace with your head, you'll have a bigger one than any of us.
Maybe I shall in 40 years, but I doubt it. And I doubt if I'll have time to grow a moustache like yours, sir. But in 1983, at least I shall be able to say that 40 years ago, I was a fellow of Enterprise.
I'll punch your head for that, young fellow. You young puppy, put him up. Take that. I'll teach you. Think you can say what you like to an old one, do you?
So that's at the start of the film, and yeah, we've got this pompous blowhard of a character who's very up himself and really kind of doesn't understand the way World War II ultimately needed to be fought. So right at the start, he's not particularly a sympathetic character. He is slightly buffoon, and he is a bit silly, and the makeup for Roger Livesey, I should say, is very, very good and is part of it. So they then go into the flashback, and he's a young officer in 1902 who, over a nurse, gets into an altercation with a German officer, Theo Kretschmar-Schuldorf, played by Anton Warbrook. And it's very kind of nice. There's a comedy of manners part to this film when they do a sabre duel, and Wing Candy gets a scar on his lip and decides to grow the moustache that was mentioned by the young officer in that previous clip. So we understand the reasons why he grows a moustache now. And it moves on from there. And Theo and Clive Wing Candy become very good friends. World War I happens, and Theo is taken prisoner, and that alters their friendship somewhat. But it's ultimately when World War II occurs, and Theo is a refugee. Now, refugees, particularly in Australia at the moment, it's a very important issue for us. And there's a speech made by Anton Warbrook in this film which goes to the heart of what it is to be a refugee, whether it's in 1943 or slightly earlier, or whether it's in 2011. So I'm going to play that one for you now, because I seriously believe that it's one of the best little speeches in English language cinema. I always get a bit choked up when I play it this, so if I come back with a slightly rough voice, I do apologise. But it's an incredibly brave piece of cinema to do in England in 1943. And the Archers really did have a lot of guts in what they did. And they were true to what they believed. And they were true to a kind of human principle that had nothing to do with religion or anything else. There's no evidence that either Powell or Pressburg were particularly religious, but to the idea of a better human race. There's nothing quite like this. Theo is being interviewed by an English bureaucrat, an English officer, to ascertain whether he's a legitimate refugee or not.
If you don't mind, sir.
No, go ahead.
In earlier years, the most important principle of my life used to be never lie, always tell the truth.
Very good principle. I hope you stick to it.
Oh, I have not told a lie, but I also have not told the truth.
The refugee soon learns that there's a big difference between the two.
The truth about me is that I'm a tired old man who came to this country because he's homesick. Oh, please don't stare at me like that, sir. I'm all right in the head. You know that after the war, we had very bad years in Germany. We got poorer and poorer. Every day, retired officers and school teachers were caught shoplifting. Money lost its value. The price of everything rose, except of human beings. We read in the papers, of course, that the after-war years were bad everywhere, that crime was increasing, and that the honest citizens were having a hard job to put the gangsters in jail. Well, I needn't tell you, sir, that in Germany, the gangsters finally succeeded in putting the honest citizens in jail. My wife was English. She would have loved to come back to England, but it seemed to me that I would be letting down my country in its greatest need, and so she stayed at my side. When in summer 33 we found that we had lost our children to the Nazi party, and I was willing to come, she died. None of my sons came to her funeral. Heil Hitler. And then in January 35, I had to go to Berlin on a mission for my firm. Driving up in my car, I lost my way on the outskirts of the city, and suddenly, the landscape seemed so familiar to me. And slowly I recognized the road, the lake, and a nursing home where I spent some weeks recovering. Almost 40 years ago. I stopped the car and sat still, remembering. And you see, in this very nursing home, sir, I met my wife for the first time. And I met an Englishman who became my greatest friend. And I remember the people at the station in 19, when we prisoners were sent home, cheering us, treating us like friends. The faces of a party of distinguished men round the table who tried their utmost to comfort me when the defeat of my country seemed to me unbearable. And very foolishly, I remember the English countryside, the gardens, the green lawns, the weedy rivers and the trees. She loved so much. And a great desire came over me to come back to my wife's country. And this, sir, is the truth.
A lot of things you can say about the life and death of the Colonel Blimp, the way Deborah Carr, with whom Michael Powell was in love at the time, played the three main women in Clive Wincandy's life, just the setting of it, the beautiful set design, the beautiful technicolor filming, but that speech really does say it all. It's an amazing piece of cinema for its time, and I love the way that Anton Warbrook understates what he says. He doesn't dramatize it. He doesn't emphasize overly any particular aspect of it. He just lays it out there, and it's an amazing piece of cinema. I'm going to take a break, and when I get back, I'm going to talk about one of the great films noir from the 1940s, being Laura, directed and produced by Otto Preminger.
While the global media is focusing on the aftermath of the global financial crisis, debating on whether global warming is scientifically sound or merely a political stunt, or reporting on citizens around the world toppling cruel dictatorships, I want to know why they're not focusing on the big issues. Is chess a better label than Sun? Did Richard Thompson or Britney Spears do a better version of Whoops, I Did It Again? Is Lou Reed or Van Morrison a grumpier old man? Do you think you two are a crap band? Do these issues matter in your life? They matter in mine. That's why I host Love That Album, a podcast based around music minutia.
Join me, Morris Bushdinski, as every fortnight, myself and a guest host will dissect a favourite album right down to its bare bones and discuss some of the latest music news. You can find the podcast either on the blog site lovethatalbum.blogspot.com or at lovethatalbum.podbean, that's podbean.com, or just type in Love That Album, or one word, into iTunes. If your heart pumps to the beat of a Keith Moon drum fill, then I'd recommend you see a cardiologist. Failing that, you probably care about music passionately, in which case, join me for Love That Album, and you won't even have to drive your car into a swimming pool.
Was the Mr. Jack and the lovely Jill. As the story goes, they went up the hill. But I beg to differ with the well-known tale. They did not go up the hill just to fill up the pail. Don't believe everything you read. Storybook not guaranteed. If we told the actual truth, it would not be good for our youth. The Cinderella left at the midnight chime, but she did not get home till morning time. And the pumpkin story in the storybook is what she told her stepmother to get off the hook. Don't believe everything. everything you read. Storybook not guaranteed. If we told the actual truth, it would not be good for our youth. The woman in the shoe had the bunch of kids. As the story goes, she was on the skids. But I tell you truly what I'm certain of. To have so much in the family, you must have the love. I know. Don't believe everything you read. Storybook not guaranteed. If we told the actual truth, it would not be good for our youth. There were the seven dwarfs and the Snow White gal. As the story goes, she was just their pal. Every country knows the story at a glance, but you should hear how it goes when they tell it in France. Comprenez-vous? Don't believe everything you read. Storybook not guaranteed. If we told the actual truth, oh no, it would not be good for our youth. Olé! If I'd only listened to my mother and learned to breathe in my diaphragm.
That was Eve Arden with Don't Believe Everything You Read, which I found in an obscure record online. Let's move on to Laura. Laura is an interesting film. It was originally going to be directed by Ruba Mamoulian, who did one of the great Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde adaptations in the 1930s, but the producer, who was Otto Preminger, didn't like the way things were going, and he decided to direct it himself. He got rid of both the director and the cinematographer. Lucien Ballard was going to be the cinematographer on the film. He later went on to do things like a bunch of Charles Bronson movies like Breakheart Pass and things like that, but he got the sack from that, from this particular gig. And Joseph Lachelle went on to become the cinematographer for Laura. He went on to do some interesting things as well. For instance, Fallen Angel and Roadhouse, two movies I like. He was the cinematographer on both of those. Both of them film noir, both of them excellent. He went on to do television later on, as indeed did a lot of the studio cinematographers and other technicians from the 40s and 50s when the studio system broke down. But anyway, getting back to Laura, interesting movie, terrific cast. You couldn't ask for a better cast in this type of film. You've got, of course, Jean Tierney playing Laura. Interesting actress. She did have a lot of problems, and if you read her biography, not always a happy life, but she came to terms with it in the end and lived well. You've got Dana Andrews, a good, tough character actor. Went on to have a few problems with the alcohol. In fact, if you look at some of his work, in particularly the 60s, it's a bit like Wendell Corey. If you look at Wendell Corey's work at a certain time, there's a slurred speech pattern, which Dana Andrews also had. He later on went on to be religious and got his act together ultimately. But I liked him as an actor, particularly in a film called Cracking the World. As an older actor, he was interesting in that. He did a number of other things. But then we get on to Clifton Webb, who was a big heartthrob in the silent movie era. And this was his first movie since the silent movie era, Laura, where he played Waldo Leidecker, the bitchy columnist who befriends Laura Hunt and ultimately plays a part in her fate. We've got Vincent Price, a very young and good-looking and dashing Vincent Price. We've got an Australian actress, Judith Anderson, who later went on to be Dame Judith Anderson. People remember her as the old Vulcan chick in the second Star Trek movie, but she had a long and distinguished career as an actor. And then, of course, you've got things like the music by my favourite film composer of all time, David Raxon. You can get it on CD, and you can buy the music online for the theme from Laura, and there are any number of adaptations of it. Johnny Mercer did a version with lyrics a couple of years later, which Raxon didn't particularly like the lyrics. But he did that. It became a big hit. There's a French version by Jean Sablon, there are a bunch of other versions. It became a jazz standard, this song, with and without the lyrics. And David Raxon basically created it in 5 days on demand. They were going to use Sophisticated Lady by Duke Ellington, but decided not to go with that. They got Raxon in because he was a studio composer at the time. He just got a kind of Dear John letter from his wife and wrote the music using the emotional tone that he was feeling himself at the time, which is kind of interesting. And maybe it's the reason why the theme from Laura really works. It's got that kind of poignance and that sense of loss that obviously Raxon was feeling at the time. So, like all good artists, of course, he used what his own emotional tone to increase his work and to enhance his work, and that's a fantastic way of doing it. Now, I'm just going to play a bit from the start of the film, which is a bit of narrative from Waldo Lydecker right at the start of the film, and you do get a little bit of David Raxon's wonderful music in that. And then I'll come back and talk about how twisted and interesting this film is.
I shall never forget the weekend Laura died. A silver sun burned through the sky like a huge magnifying glass. It was the hottest Sunday in my recollection. I felt as if I were the only human being left in New York. For with Laura's horrible death, I was alone. I, Waldo Lydecker, was the only one who really knew her. And I had just begun to write Laura's story when another of those detectives came to see me. I had him wait. I could watch him through the half-open door. I noted that his attention was fixed upon my clock. There was only one other in existence, and that was in Laura's apartment, in the very room where she was murdered.
Okay, I suppose it's time for me to do a little bit of a plot on this one. If you haven't seen it, it's probably useful for you to know this. Let's see what we've got. A police detective falls in love with the woman whose murder he's investigating is the IMDb one on that one, which pretty much covers a lot of it. The detective's Mark McPherson, played by Daniel Andrews. He's investigating the murder of beautiful and highly successful advertising executive Laura Hunt. This is the Wikipedia now. Who's been killed by a shotgun blast to the face just inside the door of her apartment before the start of the film. He interviews charismatic newspaper columnist Waldo Lydecker, an imperious decadent dandy who relates how he met Laura, became her mentor, and used his considerable influence and fame to advance her career. McPherson also questions Laura's parasitic playboy fiancé, Shelby Carpenter, played by Vincent Price, her wealthy socialite aunt, Anne Treadwell, by Dame Judith Anderson, who'd been carrying on with Carpenter and giving him money, and her loyal housekeeper, Bessie, played by Dorothy Adams. And basically, this is a police procedural to a certain extent, but it's the characters that really make this film work. And by the way, I did misspeak a little while ago. Dame Judith Anderson was in the third Star Trek movie, Search for Spock, not the second one. So I don't want any Trekkies getting up me for that one. So basically it's interesting, and it moves along at quite an interesting pace. The characters are introduced fairly quickly. The murderer is introduced fairly early in the scene. I'm not going to give it away. And, I've been reading up on Laura and found out a number of interesting things. For instance, there are three characters who all seem a bit gay and only two that seem heterosexual in this film. Waldo Lydecker, of course, Clifton Webb's character, Webb himself was gay, is very kind of effete. And that gives us an interesting kind of subtext to why is this guy so interested in Laura and why is he so interested in her career? Is he a closet heterosexual? Does he want the ultimate fag hag? Is he playing the Henry Higgins role in a kind of twisted, fucked up version of My Fair Lady or Pygmalion? What are his motives? And you never quite understand what his motives are for being the mentor for Laura Hunt. And that brings us to an interesting place in that. It's fairly obvious that he is gay, but in film noir, of course, gay is coded with evil and law-breaking and transgressive and all those sorts of things. Because, of course, just by being homosexual and actively homosexual in those days, you were breaking the law, so you were on that kind of side of the good-evil dynamic as people perceived it at the time. But he's not the only one. You've got Vincent Price's Shelby Carpenter, who's tall and charming and basically sponging off Anne Treadwell. And he's a very mild character. He's playing a little bit weak and a little bit effete, in a sense. And there is a kind of slight gay seeming. Yeah, he does ping your gaydar a little bit in this one. Even though, of course, he is interested in both Laura and Treadwell and another young lady who's a model that Laura's agency uses, a girl called Diane Redfern, who becomes a part of the film as the plot progresses. So, yeah, but even so, he's coded as a kind of weak, effete character in the kind of pantheon we have with films noir. And then, of course, there's Anne Treadwell, played by Judith Anderson. People remember her from a few years earlier before this, playing Mrs. Danvers in Rebecca, the Hitchcock film. And in Rebecca, she's pretty obviously a lesbian who's in love with Rebecca. And a little bit of that kind of imperious, forthright, almost masculine character comes across in Anne Treadwell as well. She bosses Shelby around. She's very upfront about who she is and what she wants. So that makes her code in the film as male almost. Then, of course, you've got Laura Ann McPherson, the detective. They're the very straight in a number of ways characters. They're the only ones that don't have too much deceit in them. Of course, Shelby's sponging off women, and Waldo has his secrets, and Anne Treadwell, of course, has a kept man and is pretty, you know, it's not really hidden very much that she's doing that. So they've each got their secrets. But the film does hold together really, really interestingly. You get straight into the murder, you get straight into the characters available, you get straight into the bitchy dialogue and the nastiness of Waldo Lydecker and how he's in the past has dissuaded Laura from being engaged with other men. Even though he himself isn't a romantic interest of hers, she was involved with an artist who painted that famous portrait of Laura, which in real life isn't really a portrait. It's a large photograph of Jean Tinley that they painted over with oils to make it look like a painting. But so he's kind of cock-blocking Laura's relationships for no reason apart from the fact that he doesn't want to share her. It's almost like he's got a doll that he doesn't want to let other kids play with, in a sense. And even though he doesn't himself, in any real sense, want to play with her. But, even getting Clifton Webb for the role was very difficult. Daryl Zanuck didn't want to use Clifton Webb because Webb was gay, for instance. He wanted some other actor to play it as well. They were originally going to get Jennifer Jones to play Laura, but ultimately, they did decide on Jean Tinney. I don't think Jennifer Jones had the presence that Jean Tinney does. Jean Tinney wasn't a fantastic actress. She wasn't nuanced in a lot of ways, but she did have a few good roles. There's this one. There's the psychotic character in Leave Her to Heaven. There's a few other little bits and pieces. She did a really interesting one in the 1950s called The Left Hand of God with Humphrey Bogart, which I kind of liked as well. I got a lot of time for her as an actress, and she was a stunningly beautiful woman at a time when Hollywood was full of stunningly beautiful women. But the film, as I said, the filming, they started with Ruben Mamoulian and then moved on to Preminger himself directing the film. But apparently the problems with Mamoulian were pretty much he didn't give much support to Jean Tinney and Dana Andrews. They were fairly new at acting and film acting. And he didn't keep Judith Anderson, who was a stage actress, under control very much, and she played her role a little too large, which was kind of knocking the balance of the film out a bit. And Mamoulian also pretty much ignored Clifton Webb. And so Zadig saw the early rushes of the film and had a meeting with Mamoulian and Preminger, and they were bitching about it, whose fault is it, whose fault isn't it, and that kind of thing. And Preminger, playing the office politics, convinced Zadig that they needed to go subtler with the film than Mamoulian was willing to give it. So basically Mamoulian was out, Preminger was in, and then went on to have a career as a director, of course. And they did things like they brought the role of Waldo Lydecker into more prominence than it had in the original novel. And this was based on a novel by a lady called Vera Caspari, who was a communist, and her career kind of got a bit sidelined during the 1940s and 1950s for exactly that reason. But the film is a classic. I mean, it's got all of the, it hits all the right notes for a good film noir. Joseph Lachaud won an Academy Award for Best Black and White Cinematography for this film, so obviously Preminger did pick the right cinematographer. Preminger was nominated for Best Director. Clifton Webb was nominated for Best Supporting Actor, but he lost out to Barry Fitzgerald in Going My Way, playing a kind of Mick priest of some kind. I don't watch religious movies much, but I'm just kind of diminishing that. The interesting thing is seeing who loses to whom in the Oscars, particularly in the earlier days, where you have two character actors going up against each other, and they always pick the worst one possible out of the nominees for some reason. But, and the film is a classic. There's a two-disc DVD set out there. I don't know whether it's out on Blu-ray yet, but if it isn't, I'll probably try to find it when it is. And the other thing I was going to mention is there was a television adaptation of Laura in 1968, and they chose Lee Bouvier, who later became Lee Reservoir in the Jean Tierney part. She's the sister of Jackie Kennedy Onassis, and was kind of a socialite who was dabbling in cinema, in acting, sorry. And everyone really gave her the shit for the role. It was really a bad piece of cinema. The screenplay was written by Truman Capote, in fact, and George Sanders played Clifton Webb's character, which I can see working, but the rest of it apparently is a piece of shit, and I don't even know whether it's available at all. But, Laura, I'm going to play the trailer from Laura, just to ride this one out. But I find it fascinating, and every time I watch it, I see new little nuances, particularly in Waldo's character. I'm trying to understand that character and understand his motivation, man. Maybe the way Webb played it kind of clouds the water a little bit on that, but really it's one of the great classics. And if you can find the soundtrack, I definitely recommend that you do. It's usually paired up with a bunch of other David Raxon soundtracks, including The Bad and the Beautiful, and a few other ones. And it's just a lovely piece of music to play in the background while you're doing anything. It really does have what a good soundtrack needs to have.
I remember when Laura bought these glasses, she loved them.
I was groping for some way to keep Laura's name out of it.
She was always quick to seize upon anything that would improve her mind or her appearance. Laura had innate breeding. I selected a more attractive hairdress for her. I taught her what clothes were more becoming to her. Through me, she met everyone. Men admired her. Women envied her.
You have rarely met a girl like Laura. Few women have been so beautiful, so exotic, so dangerous to know.
You're Laura Hunt, aren't you?
Yes.
I'm Shelby Carpenter. Want a dance?
I'm not alone.
Oh, you poor girl. I bet he still does the polka.
Yes, Betsy Ross taught it to me.
It was as natural for Laura to be picked out from among thousands of alluring girls as it was for her to be surrounded by luxury, mystery, and scheming men.
Get going.
You better watch out, McPherson, or you'll end up in a psychiatric ward.
I don't think I've ever had a patient who fell in love with a corpse.
Miss Hunt and I were going to be married this week, you know.
No, he doesn't know. And neither do I, or you, or anyone else alive.
What do you mean by that?
As a matter of fact, she was going to the country to think it over. She was extremely kind, but I was always sure she would never have thrown her life away on a male beauty in distress.
Every woman will feel that when it comes to men, Laura gets by with murder. Every man will feel that when it comes to murder, it couldn't involve a more enticing girl.
Don't worry. I told you I'd bring in the killer today. Yeah, I was just going to make the arrest when you call. No, I can't tell you now. I'm not alone. You'll see when I come in.
Time for the feedback from the listeners.
Hey, this is Richard from Wichita. It seems like it has been forever since I've left a voicemail. And I just wanted to say that I am still out there, still listening, but I have been woefully behind on episodes. So I didn't feel like it was really worth commenting on movies that you talked about, you know, months or weeks ago. So the good news is that as we are approaching the Thanksgiving holiday here, just a few days away here in the States, I am finally caught up on my podcast. Work has slowed down a little bit, has allowed me to catch up in addition to a 7.5-hour road trip. So with that, I'm kind of making the rounds and leaving some voicemails in some of the shows, and wanted to leave a voicemail with you and say I've been loving the episodes. Not going to comment on all of them other than just a couple of quick things here. Loved your discussion on the Humphrey Bogart film In a Lonely Place. I'm a big Bogart fan, but I haven't seen anything from Bogart probably in at least 2 or 3 years. I went through this phase back in the 80s and 90s where I was trying to watch everything I could of Bogart's. And, then I was down to just a handful of titles, and probably in the last 5 or 6 years, I've only seen a couple of Bogart films, to be honest with you. And I'm not finished by far. I still have some Bogart films I want to see. And in fact, this is one of them that I've never seen before. So it was really cool and listening to your discussion and the clips that you played. I'm going to have to seek this one out. I don't know if this one pops up on Turner Classic Movies or not. They do play a lot of Bogart from time to time. So I'm going to have to take a look and see. I know a while back they did like a Bogart Day that I missed. I didn't realize it until like 2 or 3 days after the fact, so a little disappointed, and I think it may have been played that day. But in any case, I'm making a note of this one. I want to try to seek it out and maybe catch it in the next 2012 as I'm kind of compiling a list of movies that I want to see first before anything else. So I think it's time for some Bogart. The last Bogart film I saw, again, was at least, I think, maybe 2 or 3 years ago. And I believe it was one of his last films, or maybe his last film, Beat the Devil. It's public domain, and watched it on my iPod. So, and actually, it was much better than I thought it would be. I hadn't heard too much good about it, but I was actually kind of enjoying. A little quirky, but and not his best work, but still entertaining. So it was good to hear you talk about that. And I like some of the things you've been doing to kind of stir things up. And I love the A to Z thing you've been doing. And I think that's an awesome idea. Equally awesome, though, is to change things up a little bit. Going with the Dr. Zom, kind of changing pace for that. That's Dr. Zom worries me. He's a scary guy. He makes me laugh, which I guess makes me scary. I don't know. He's funny. And it's a change of pace. I enjoy the conversations with him. They're just they're informative, and then all of a sudden he throws you a curve and you're out in left field. I like the waffling through the years. I think that was a cool idea. I'd like to see more of that periodically. And then the killers times too. I thought was kind of interesting. So you know, the, again, approach of the way you handle that episode. So, love bouncing around what you're doing. Saw your recent Facebook post asking for some guidance on films starting with L, and I know that Vince from the B-Movie cast provided more than enough titles. So just want to let you know that I'm enjoying the show as always. Good luck on the ongoing renovations to the house. We have just come off of months of doing ours here, a combination of a storm that we had earlier in the summer. We finally got all of that work done, new roof and new gutters and siding work and painting and miscellaneous repairs related to that, as well as interior changes, new carpet. My daughter moved out this summer, so my office got moved from one side of the house to the other side and upstairs. So new painting and all decorating and moving 8 million in one books out of the basement and back into my library upstairs. So, yes, I commiserate with you that it is a long, drawn-out pain in the ass, but the end result, I'm sure you'll enjoy it. So, it's good to hear that things are maybe settling down a little bit on the home front. So, with that, loving the show as always. Take care, and we will talk to you soon.
Thanks, Richard. Always love your feedback. And on that, Dr. Zombie's not scary. He's a lovely guy. All the people who saw him in Cincinnati at Horror Hound Weekend can attest to that, even though he does do a wicked booty dance with Alex. He's a valuable part of this, and I really love the guy for his enthusiasm, his knowledge, and his podcast, for that matter. Silver and Gold is going from strength to strength, and they're really doing good stuff, him and Alex. And it's good to when a couple of basically nutters get together and just groove on what they're doing. It's always a lovely thing, whether the nutters are myself and Zom, or whether Zom and Alex, or Sammy and Big Willie over at Gentleman's Guide to Midnight Cinema, or whether it's Vince, Mary and Nick over at B-Movie Cast. I've really got to get organized and get more people onto the podcast. I always say that, and I accept that I always say that. But I haven't even been able to get into the library here for about a week and a half until this morning when I moved all the chairs out. The floors were finally done. So, yeah, the renovations are a pain in the ass, but they are worth it. We're still in the process of putting things back together. I did take a break in the middle of recording this podcast. I took a nap for an hour or so, and then I got up and shoveled wet sand into a wheelbarrow and carried it around the back of the house to just fill up a bit of a pit we've got in the backyard. So, it's an interesting, ongoing, pain-in-the-ass kind of thing, but we're getting there. We're in the last bits of it now. And I do hope that things are much better as a result of that. So, but yeah, Bogart, talking about Bogart, if you can get across the Pacific, that's a good one to do. Left Hand of God's good. I do like the Barefoot Contessa, if you can find it, but these things come up occasionally on Turner Classic Movies, at least here in Australia, so keep your eyes open and you'll find what you're looking for. On to the next bit.
Hey, Terry, it's Brian here. got a couple of suggestions for your L films. It's actually quite a clever little idea, even if I do say so myself. So my idea is to do London After Midnight and La Jete. Because even though London After Midnight is a lost film, they did do the reconstruction in, I think, 2002 with some still photographs that were found from on set. And I think it's a special feature, but you can get the disc as well that reconstructs the film just in stills. And, of course, La Jete is the French short that was inspired, that inspired Terry Gilliam's 12 Monkeys, that is, again, just a load of still photographs, so it's a nice little link. So, aren't I a clever bunny? So maybe that would be a good show for your episode for Els. And can you believe it's near enough the end of the year? So happy days anyway. So great show and always. All right, cheers, Tara.
That was our friend Brian from over at the Hammockers podcast. I'm going to be on Hammockers again in a little while. We're doing the Richard Lester Three Musketeers, so I'm looking forward to that. It's always nice to have a chat with Brian, and it's one of those things I don't get to do nearly enough. So, the Els, La Jete, I recommend people find La Jete and watch it. I did see it in the cinema a fair while ago. It was shown just as a little four thing before something else. I wonder if it's available on YouTube. I'm just going to check this out and see whether it is, if my connection's fast. I found out something interesting about my Wi-Fi connection in the library here. If I put my lava lamp switched on too close to the laptop, it fucks any Wi-Fi signal. I do not know why, but apparently lava lamps are kryptonite to Wi-Fi signals. It's a mystery, and if someone would care to investigate, I'd be interested to find out the results of that. But the lava lamp has now been moved away, along with the talking Halloween skull, which sounds like this. That's what it sounds like. But, I've decided I'm going to decorate this area a little more than I have. So I've got a lava lamp here now. I've got the skull. It's basically a mummy skull with glowing LED eyes. I've got an Azan clock that I picked up in Dubai, which, if I set it upright, will tell me when the call to prayer is. It's a special kind of clock that Muslim people have for the call to prayer five times a day, and you can set the alarm for the call to prayer, and it does the muezzin's call to prayer. Let me see if I can set that up. Hang on a sec. I'm just going to see if I can do it and get this thing going. Won't be a tick. I'm playing around at the moment, so bear with me. Yes, so I've got that. I've got a little tiny matchbox toy car of a 1960 Citroen. What else have I got around here? I have my machete that I picked up in Darwin and a bunch of other miscellaneous shit. So I'm actually building a little bit of an environment here, and of course a lava lamp with the red lava in it. Thanks for this feedback and the suggestions, Brian. La Jetée, you can find, if you search around a little bit, you've got to do a pretty deep search on YouTube, you can find La Jetée in the original French with English subtitles, which is a groovy thing. But if you can find it on DVD, all the better. I think Chris Marker, the director and writer of La Jetée, was an American, even though it was done in Paris, so I'm pretty sure of that. The other film, London After Midnight, I wasn't able to score a copy of that, but it'd be a great addition to it. I do like myself a bit of Lon Chaney. The interesting thing is I've never seen the Lon Chaney Hunchback of Notre Dame, but I did, when I was a kid, see the Charles Laughton one from 1936, and I liked it. Charles Laughton, fine actor, but I'd really have to track down a few Hunchback of Notre Dame movies, of course, except the Disney one, because Disney always pollutes and diminishes anything it touches. It's like kryptonite for any artistic work, Disney. But, they're great suggestions, Brian, and I do appreciate them. 12 Monkeys, I got a bit of a soft spot for 12 Monkeys too, even though Brad Pitt overacts the fuck in that movie. I do like it, and I think it's one of the better things that Bruce Willis has done, because basically Terry Gilliam said to him, don't do any of these Bruce Willis things, and he gave him a list. But, so thank you for that, Brian. Happy days, mate. And I look forward to talking to you soon when we do Hammickers.
Paleo Cinema. This is Dr. Zon in his revelry. Listen, as is me proving that it's me with my ever-present tuberculosis, whatever the fact is. I've already left feedback, and I don't want to be obnoxious, but I remembered that you posed the question, why aren't there any tough guys in Hollywood anymore? And I wanted to chime in. The other day I woke up and was quite out of it, if you will. Yes, I was quite out of it. But I actually pondered the question that you posed to the masses of your fans, fanboys, fans, sickle fans, as Alec Guinness would say. The one thing that I was thinking, well, there's several reasons why my boy, my mate, my old chap, old man, the reasons that there are no tough guys in Hollywood. First of all, Hollywood, it's almost like a Tyler Durden type attitude, or what he was speaking of, about men not being men anymore, men being raised by women, and no man around, which, I don't know if I agree with that, because some of the toughest bastards that I knew growing up in the hood were fatherless sons. So I'm not sure about that, but it actually, the lack of a father figure put them out. It's probably more of a poor home upbringing that put them out on the street, and they would have to fend for themselves and learn to fight. And with some of the fathers that I know, they're better off not having a father figure. Row! Anyway, but Hollywood seems to go for, these days, a, what is, I think, what's been thrust upon us by certain people, or what a real man is, or what an idol or an icon is. They want their little chiseled Apollos, under 6 feet tall, basically male models who dress a certain way, who take steroids so that they can have a washboard ab and cut-up body. They like that chiseled little Greek god look, and it's as phony as the Victoria's Secret anorexic concentration camp victims that they thrust upon us. Concentration camp victims with good hair and makeup, I call them. One of the few these days, like him or not, that I find to be like the old school tough guys is Russell Crowe from your neck of the woods. And he's a sportsman, plays rugby, soccer, rugby, Australian size, style football. And so he comes from that Oliver Reed kind of background, rough and tumble boys, hard drinking. And Russell Crowe can be quite a, he can be obnoxious at times. But also, you see Russell Crowe, and he's not the man who worries about the washboard dabs and stuff like that. Usually, you catch pictures of him with a belly, a little bit overweight, but looking like a real scruffy, hairy, big man. Another Hollywood thing, and this goes back to William Holden days, where they would shave off all their body hair. A real man like me, like Dr. Sun, a hairy man, a burly man, a man who takes no shit from no one. Well, I take shit from women quite a bit, but from men, yeah, I take shit from them too. I'm actually kind of a big pussy. But anyway, I think they go for that certain look, and also, like with De Niro and Dustin Hoffman and that kind of group, they're more from the theater, actors. He's had a sprinkling of guys like Gene Hackman, who like to go out and smack people, you know, just while he was making a movie, because just he would get so much so tense and so much anxiety and shit, he'd like to go out to a bar and smack some people. But that even goes back, that's back then. But it crossed over to De Niro, to Dustin Hoffman, and things like that. And then today you have Bradley Cooper, Chris Evans, the little James Bond guy that is around, who has sort of a boxer's face, but when you look at him, he's taking some steroids because nobody looks like that all the time. Cut up, you know, and some of them, to get that look, to get that chiseled look, of course, they do like some... They're working out, but they're also doing like a cycle of steroids to get that look. But they also, Michael Fassbender, his face, he's so skinny. I love Fassbender. I think he's a good actor. But, you know, he just, sometimes his face looks so drawn. You know, you don't have the William Smith, you don't have the Clint Eastwood. You know, we can go on and on with Mitchum and Lee Marvin, blah, 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 blah. I do think your point is correct about not the most countries these days didn't have that mandatory military service. So that falls in there, too. It's just a pussy world out there. And Hollywood doesn't want a real man, because a real man... Hollywood wants a dandy. And if they do have a guy who is playing a rough-and-tumble role, they just jack up a, you know... I don't know what I'm trying to say, but I think there's just a lot of reasons, and I think one of the main reasons is just casting. They like the magazine ad guys. They like the model-looking guys. And as most of our community say about the women, that we like women that have, you know, meat, without being crass, meat on their bones, but we are forced to, that the ideal is the bag of bones, the anorexic, bulimic, supermodels. It goes the same for the men. The women's ideal that is shoved down their throat is 0% body fat, cut up, washboard abs, and 5'7" or something like that. But in reality and the real world, which is where we live, the real men and the real women still exist, and one of them is the Frost Giant, Terry Frost, a paleo cinema, a real man, a strapping man, a man's man, if you will. I babble along. I'm watching Quadrophenia right now. I'm going to be reviewing it on Maurice's show. Love that album, coming up this morning, so I better get back to it. But I just wanted to share a few thoughts there. I totally agree with what you're saying, and I don't foresee it changing in the future because, as I've said before, most men that I know would rather see Russ Meyers-type women, but even though the majority like those kind of women, we still get the supermodels, the thin stick figures, and we're still going to continue to get... These little chiseled gods. And what happened to the gods? Nothing happened to them because they didn't exist. I think that when we start seeing Daniel Craig and some of these guys getting a little bit older and they start losing that youthful look, you know, they'll turn maybe kind of Russell Crowe-ish, put on a little bit of weight. And I also think that once you reach a certain power, Russell Crowe has a certain amount of power in Hollywood. He doesn't give a shit. He's a good actor. So if he gains a little bit of weight, he doesn't care. Whereas a lot of them, I think it's almost like they have to protect their looks. They have to work out constantly. They have to do a little bit of body enhancing chemicals because they don't have the acting ability. Look at say Chris Evans, Bradley Cooper, Daniel Craig, or somebody like that. If they got up to 250 pounds, could their acting ability still carry a role? Anyway, this is Dr. Tom. Got to get back to Quadrophenia, mate. I will speak to you later, Tom.
Thanks, Tom. Yeah, I'm definitely a real man. I mean, I'm hairy. I've got a bit of a gut. And what else? I'm a 5'11", so I'm about 4 inches taller than those guys that Hollywood seems to want. But I don't care. I'm happy with who I am. And I'm working on losing the gut a bit. He said, having just eaten a piece of chocolate. And yeah, but real men, I mean, basically, I think there's a certain life. You've got to have confidence in yourself. One of the most attractive things to women, I know, I mean, apart from licking your eyebrows, is confidence in a guy. And a lot of these guys, particularly something like Ryan Reynolds in Green Lantern, plays a guy with no confidence. He's a fucking fighter pilot, and yet he's scared. You don't be a fighter pilot if you're scared. That's the main disconnect I have with that film. I've got a friend who's a big Green Lantern fan, and a Green Lantern apologist. But nah, I think the whole story in that one sucked, and basically they were trying to every man someone who's supposed to be an extraordinary hero. and I don't think it really worked. So, yeah, I think the real men should come back in film. They mostly come back as either villains or Jason Statham. And sometimes Jason Statham playing a villain. But there's not too many of them out there, and it's an interesting thing because there are certain roles that require it. And it's not just being soldiers. I mean, there are a whole bunch of different actors playing soldiers these days. But soldiers are, in a sense, company men. They're not that kind of rugged, independent loner that we like from a lot of our action cinema. They're people working within a system, where the best characters in cinema are people who don't work within a system. People like Rick in Casablanca, people like just about everybody except Winston Churchill that Rod Taylor ever played. All of those kind of characters are a kind of standalone, and I like that in cinema. And yeah, I do like women with curves on them. There's just so much more there, and I do like them with a bit of meat on them, preferably my own. Let's get back to the feedback.
Paleo Cinema. This is Dr. Lam. Paleo. I purchased a movie over Horror Hound Weekend in Cincinnati, Ohio, and I haven't yet to even purchase this. Had to rewind there, Paleo, because I got a little tongue-tied with the coronary. Paleo Cinema, I just woke up. I'm a little bit groggy. But I wanted to leave you some feedback about a movie that I purchased at Horror Hound Weekend in Cincinnati, Ohio. I have yet to even open it. I have yet to even see it. But it was nominated for 1963 Academy Awards. That movie is called The Cardinal by Otto Preminger. Paleo Cinema, because I know that you're down with Ronald Reagan's soft cock, and because I know that Paleo Cinema is a very spiritual podcast. Surely you jest, Zom. Yes, yes, I jest. But the movie is called The Cardinal, an Otto Preminger film. I haven't even opened it yet. I haven't even watched it. I have no idea what it's about. But I assume that the master, the frost giant, will have seen it, will have known about it, will be able to speak about it. And it's a rich story embracing interfaith marriage, abortion, racism, and war. Paleo Cinema, I'm going to watch this movie. Tell me what you think about this movie. Paleo, Dr. Zom, saying, we wish that Teddy would have been able to be at Horror Hound Weekend, because only he could dwarf the John Saxon in scope. What was that? Was that some kind of Ghostbuster? Because if there's something strange in the neighborhood, who are you going to call? Ghostbusters, that's who. This is Dr. Zom rambling like a bubble-headed booby, saying Zom out.
Of course, that was the first of Zom's feedback voicemails. The Cardinal, I haven't seen it in a long time. I saw it centuries ago. I do remember John Huston playing a cardinal in, or playing one of those Vatican hierarchy dudes in it. But, yeah, it slips from my memory because it's basically about religious people. And I have a personal disconnect with that kind of shenanigans. Nonetheless, I'm going to have to revisit it just to see all the character actors, because I've just gone through the IMDb on this, and let's see who's in this. Tom Tryon, of course, another closeted gay actor of the time. Carol Linley's in it, Dorothy Gish, Maggie McNamara's in it, Cecil Kellaway, an actor who spent a chunk of his career making films here in Australia. I think he was originally English, but he did live for a long time in Australia, even though he was born in South Africa. But let's see who else. John Huston, of course. Robert Morse is in it for some reason. I've got to check that out because I like a bit of Bobby Morse. Really interesting guy. Let's see who else we've got in there. Burgess Meredith. Ralph Fiennes. Chill Wills is in it. Ozzie Davis is in it. Patrick O'Neill. Murray Hamilton. People remember him from Jaws. Romy Schneider. I like Romy Schneider. She was very, very attractive. And, so it says Adolf Hitler's in there. Archive footage uncredited. Not a bad thing. So, I'm going to have to check that one out, even though the subject matter isn't my glass tea. As Clive Revel said in The Private Life of Sherlock Holmes, not my glass of tea. But, I will check it out at some stage, and I'll let you know how it went. Let me know what you thought of it once you've watched it too, Zom. I'd be interested in getting your take on it there. Let me see what else I've got. Yep, I've got one. I've got an email from Morris from Love That Cinema podcast. Let me see what he says in that email. Hey, Terry, good to see that the renovations are proceeding, that your house hasn't fallen down around yours and Sal's ears. No, it hasn't. It's not in bad nick. It's purely renovations for aesthetic reasons, basically because it's got a 1990s kitchen. I'm writing with regard to a couple of films I've watched in the past week, and what are your thoughts? The first film I saw was Cry Terror, featuring James Mason, Rod Steiger, Jack Klugman, Angie Dickinson, and Inga Stevens. I've taken a sidestep for a second here, but bear with me. A few years ago, my wife and I went to the Caribbean Gardens Market, and whilst at the cafe, I bought something purporting to be cheesecake. It was completely void of any cheese and tasted pretty bland as a result. I'd call Cry Terror the Caribbean Gardens cheesecake of films. It was a thriller with no thrills. James Mason and his wife and daughter are kidnapped by Rod Steiger, who had previously duped Mason into designing a trigger mechanism for explosives he and his gang wished to use on planes as a way of extorting the FBI for money. Steiger's logic is that the FBI will trace all the parts of the bomb to Mason and assume that he's the extortionist while he, Steiger, collects the money. Money not paid, family dies, planes are blown up. The acting was awful and the script was ridiculous. Can you imagine the manager of a bank, even the bank in any other Hollywood movie, saying that they better pay the extortion money because he wouldn't want the death of a kidnapped little girl on his conscience? The kidnappers allow their prisoners to walk around free and drive alone to pick up extortion money. Angie Dickinson's character, one of the gang members, goes out to buy a sandwich and beer on the same day her profile appears on the front of the paper for suspicion of leaving a bomb on a plane. Of course, no one recognizes her. Huh? Have you seen this? I don't think I'm being unfairly cruel. Do you think I'm being unfairly cruel to this flick? Probably not. I think I saw it once. I'm going to have to check it out again just in that kind of, yes, it's fucking horrible, but I'm going to watch it anyway kind of mode. By contrast, the other film I watched was the wonderful The Sunshine Boy, starring Walter Matthau and George Burns. Two vaudeville performers who can't stand each other are coaxed into performing with each other one last time for a TV special. On the one hand, the problems shown associated with old age are quite sad. Matthau and Burns' confusion at what's being said to them by those around them. When the two of them are working at their old shtick, however, they come to life. The two best scenes are wordless. When the two of them are moving furniture around Matthau's apartment in rehearsal for their sketch, and when they're in the dressing room before the performance, they say nothing and don't need to. These guys have the visual comic timing down to perfection. I love this film. That's all for now. I look forward to the next Paleo Cinema. Cheers, Morris. Haven't seen The Sunshine Bush for a long time. I think it turns up on TCM occasionally, so I'm going to have to check it out. I don't remember being impressed with it the first time I saw it, but I was much younger then, and I was probably looking for a movie with tits on it, and I didn't find it, unless you count Walter Matthau or George Burns's moobs. But, I'm going to check that out now, and recommendations always welcome. And again, people, lovethatalbum.blogspot.com for Morris's stuff. He and I are kind of discussing an album to do on that show. We haven't figured it out yet. I'm not sure what we're going to do, but I do want to do that, and I will be very happy to help him out and promote his podcast. By the way, anybody else, if you have podcast promos you would like to send my way, I will play them. Always happy to share the love out there. And it does seem to be working for me, sharing the love around, because this month, being November 2011, is the month that has the most downloads ever for Paleo Cinema Podcast. We do have ups and downs, but this month's been particularly fruitful for us. And it's all partly because of me. Oh, sorry, and you, the listeners. Really do appreciate the feedback. I have been getting a bit of promotion as well from the radio. Ivor's been very generous to me and has basically promoted Paleo Cinema, because it's a not-for-profit thing. They can do it on the public broadcaster, the government broadcaster being the ABC in this case. But I have been getting a little promo there. I'm not sure how much it's actually working, but it is nice that he does that as well. And one of the things he is going to do, and I've got to let you guys know this, is he's sending me a disc with the radio stuff we do on it, and he's okayed me to include some of it with Paleo Cinema. Now, Ivor sometimes forgets things that I ask him to do, and I forget things that he asked me to do. It's just one of those things we have. But I'm going to keep pushing, and I'm going to get some of the talks that he and I do on films with Frost at ABC Darwin, and I'm going to slide them in as a kind of interstitial thing in Paleo Cinema. I've got permission, and it's all a groovy thing, but I will do that. And then people who aren't otherwise able to avail themselves of the wonder that is Ivor Cole and Terry Frost talking movies, we'll be able to do so. So that's about it for the feedback. If I've missed anybody out, I'm sorry. My feedback's all over the place as far as archiving things. It's all part of the renovation. So if I have missed you out, tell me and I will play your feedback next time around. But anyway, I've got to get going now. We're 1 hour and 26 minutes into this. Again, support all of the podcasts that I've named, GGTMC, B-MovieCast, Love That Album, Hammockus, Silver and Gold, Cool Shot on the Tube, amongst other things. Also, The Writer and the Critic, which is Mondi and Kirsten, Shooting the Pooh podcast, Galactic Suburbia, any one of the ones that are on the paleo-cinema.com website. Are good people and worthy of your time and attention. So give them a go. And if you're outside your comfort zone, don't worry, you know the way back. Anyway, take care, and I will talk to everybody in 2 weeks' time with something new. It may be the M's. It may be somebody as a guest. I don't know yet, because I haven't figured it out. At the moment, I'm just looking out the window and thinking I've got to move that couch inside from under the veranda. But anyway, I'll talk to you guys soon, and enjoy your movies. And I've got some music for you. I'm leaving you with a bit of Ida Lupino.
Joe, how's business?
Finn.
Can I buy you a drink?
You're a doll.
It's 3:15. There's no one in the place except you and me.
Cozy.
Yeah. So set 'em up, Joe, because I've got a little story you ought to know.
Go.
We're drinking, my friend, to the end of a brief episode.
I'm with you.
So make it one for my baby. And another one for the road.
Got you covered.
You know, you're the only one I can talk to, Joe. Oh, I got the routine. So will you drop another nickel in the machine?
Costs a dime now.
Yeah, I forgot. Oh, I'm feeling so bad. Wish you'd make the music kind of dreamy and sad. You know what I mean, Joe? I could tell you a lot, but you've got to be sort of true to your code.
What else is there?
You said it. So make it one for my baby, and just another little one for the road.
I hear you.
You know you're the best friend I've got, Joe. Oh, you'd never know it. But, buddy, I'm a kind of poet. And I've got a lot of things to say.
Lay it on me.
I will. And when I'm gloomy, you've simply got to listen to me. Until they're talked away. That's how it goes. And Joe boy, I know you're getting anxious to close.
No, my pad's just around the corner.
That's what I like about you. So thanks for the cheer. I hope you didn't mind my bend in your ear.
What are friends for?
Oh, this torch that I found must be drowned, or it soon might explode. So make it one for my baby, and just another little one, you know, for the road. That long, oh, that long, long road.
You got a ride home?